The Debate.
And welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, on the last day of the Trump administration, U.S. and the UAE signed a deal with Washington agreeing to sell planes and drones to Abu Dhabi. The UAE will purchase up to 50 F-35 jets, 18 armed drones, and other weapons. Well, the deal is worth $23 billion. The okay from Washington has come after the UAE agreed with the U.S.'s pushing Abu Dhabi to recognize Israel and establish relations with Tel Aviv, which it did. Now, the UAE embassy in Washington, upon announcing the sale, has said that the UAE is committed to de-escalation in the region. We'll take a look at what all of this may mean on this debate. Stay tuned.
Just hours before his term as the 45th U.S. president ended, Donald Trump finalized a controversial arms deal with the United Arab Emirates. The UAE embassy in Washington confirmed signing a $23 billion worth of an arms deal with the U.S. It said Washington has agreed to deliver 50 F-35 jets, 18 armed drones, and other defense equipment. The F-35 jets are a major piece of the weapons deal, which was awarded to Abu Dhabi in return for a normalization deal with Israel. The UAE had long sought the means to purchase F-35 jets, but failed to do so until the Trump administration came into picture. The armed drones purchase is also a significant one. Experts believe it would be the second largest sale of U.S. drones to a single country. The arms deal came despite massive oppositions in and outside the U.S. In December, there were two attempts to block portions of the UAE sale. Both of them failed despite growing calls from anti-war and human rights groups to halt it. Critics of the deal believe that these weapons would likely be used to inflict harm in Libya and Yemen and could further destabilize West Asia. The UAE has been one of the main players of the Saudi-led coalition that waged a years-long war against Yemen. Abu Dhabi is also involved in the Libya conflict, where the absence of a unified government brought several countries in the war zone with the aims of controlling the oil-rich country. It has also supplied weapons to militant groups in Syria. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump has been pushing for several arms deals in his final weeks in power. First came the approval of $290 million worth of bombs for Saudi Arabia on December 29. On the same day, the State Department also announced a $4 billion sale of Apache helicopters to Kuwait. There was also a $104 million deal for defense equipment to outfit the plane of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and another $65.6 million in precision targeting equipment for Egyptian warplanes. Critics blame Washington for supporting wars and destruction by selling arms to nations that have been destabilizing West Asia. They also warn against the possibility of creating an arms race which will cause nothing but more deaths and chaos.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar out of New York and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in New York. Daniel, why do you think that this deal was not inked until the last day of Trump's reign?
Well, Trump wanted to slip it in under the wire before Biden took office, sort of present the new administration with a fait accompli, making it harder for Biden to back away from the deal. I don't think Biden will back away from the deal because I think he basically agrees with the logic of Trump's foreign policy, which is to arm the Gulf states against Iran.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you if you thought that Biden actually wanted to back away from that deal, but you've answered it. So, Mohsen, initially Israel didn't agree for the UAE to buy the F-35. So you think that was a ploy on its part, or did it later become convinced that it should? Your assessment of that side of things?
I think the assessment has probably changed to some degree. They've decided that they need their erstwhile silent partner. us, the UAE, the Saudi Arabians, Jordan, all of those buffer Muslim countries, including Egypt as well, amongst that, they've decided that they need them now to act as a physical buffer. And I think that they've initiated that partly with the Saudis' war on Yemen. You can see it there. You can see that the UAE has been commissioned to enter Yemen as well, and they've been also committing atrocities and violating that state's sovereignty. They've also, significantly, the UAE has also been allowed to start building up ports across the region. I think Somalia, Ethiopia, they've been trying to get ports at Socotra, the island just off Yemen. So you can see that there's an expansionism. And the UAE, I think from an Israel point of view, is a sort of major, it's a necessity now. Previously, perhaps they thought by handing over this equipment, it might not be reliable, it could end up in the wrong hands, and they didn't trust them. What's more likely is that the Israeli Defense Force, the American military, are taking hands-on control of all of this, this weaponry. Yeah, and it's also a backdoor way of them passing more weaponry to Syrian front and to the Yemeni front as well, I imagine. But the UAE has been a significant purchaser of US military equipment for obviously years. The latest agreement, Defense Cooperation Agreement, came into force on May the 24th, 2019. And since then, the US has been pumping out $28.1 billion in active government-to-government sales cases with the UAE under foreign military sales systems. So there's a lot of financial activity on the military front that's been going on. And of course, the double whammy is that America, which is economically, of course, troubled as well, is using the Arab states as a cash cow to milk them for sale of military hardware. Of course, this goes into the American economy as well. Israel, I think their purpose is really to bolster up these states as more practical frontline partners for them against what they will see as the axis of resistance threat.
Okay. Well, Daniel, the UAE already spends around $30 billion on its annual military budget. Iran spends around $17 billion annually. Even if Abu Dhabi considers Tehran as an adversary, it already spends almost twice the amount that Iran spends on its military budget. Why do you think that's the case? What does it all mean?
Well, I think that your other guess is correct. And I mean, that the UAE wants to transform itself into a regional military power, a regional military, economic, and strategic power. It's establishing bases down the Red Sea into the Arabian Sea. It's trying to extend its clout throughout the region, and certainly bolstering its military is one way of doing that. It wants to be a big league player. And the U.S. sees nothing wrong with that. The U.S. rather likes the idea, because Saudi Arabia is obviously deeply unstable. So therefore, the U.S. could use a substitute in that region. But I must emphasize that it's all part of a grand orchestrated strategic offensive aimed at isolating Iran and Iran's allies in Iraq, and Syria, and Lebanon.
Said Mohsen, the UAE embassy in Washington has said that it is committed to de-escalation in the region. Now, it does not appear that the amount of planes and drones that it will be acquiring is going to be used for this de-escalation. Your take on what is said, and actually we see the transaction that is going to be made.
Absolutely right. I mean, we can see from Joe Biden's posturing that he's already now going to review all these contracts and deals, so he says. But that review is, I think, going to be one of going through the motions. And in fact, I think the indication is that they're not happy with the Trump plan to de-escalate what little there was. You know, in Iraq, they were pulling out troops, ostensibly 2,500 troops out of 5,000, officially on record. We don't know the reality. So I don't think Biden has a track record which gives us any hope that he's going to change the Trump policy. In fact, it could be much, much worse. His track record is very much for supporting the beginning of wars, far more likely, some would say, than Donald Trump starting a war with the Islamic Republic or opening up new fronts against the resistance axis. You see, of course, the UAE, Biden will look at this, and during his term in the American administration. He's overseeing the Afghanistan and Iraq campaigns, the expeditionary participants, and the UAE is actually in that global coalition, hook, line, and sinker. They co-lead the global coalition's communications working group, for instance, providing what the US State Department says is strong support for counter-messaging and countering violent extremism through its Sawab and Hidayah centers, and also a co-lead of the Coalition Stabilization Working Group. So they're very much at the heart of this. It's all done under the guise that the UAE is helping America fight the war on terror. In fact, the reality is that they are probably part and parcel of the mechanism for the Americans and the Israelis keeping control of that region.
So what you're saying, Said Mohsen, basically, if I understand you, is that under a Biden administration, the situation will probably get worse than in the region because, as a matter of fact, de-escalation is going to be the last thing on the agenda. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I don't think you can see the juggernaut, the industrial military arms complex that the U.S. Spearheads needs these wars. They need these conflicts. They rely on them. You know, $7.5 trillion has gone into these wars over the last 20 or 30 years. That's a conservative estimate that we have. We know that they're signing off on more of these contracts. What we're seeing today is the latest of that. But, you know, prior to what the Americans have been trying to sign off here, they've had CH-47F cargo helicopters, terminal high-altitude area defense, the THAAD missiles, as they're known, and also newly refurbished AH-64E helicopters, large aircraft, infrared countermeasures. Mm. You know, it goes on these systems. You know, they even have Blackjack unmanned air vehicles, the Patriot sort of Javelin AIM-9X Sidewinder. I could go on. The list of actual really nasty military hardware is endless. And, you know, they've authorized, as I said earlier, permanent export of over $7.2 billion in defense articles to the UAE via their direct commercial sales process. That's an admission by the U.S. State Department. You don't know what's going on the black market, of course. Right. Whatever's going on the side, it's a different story.
Well, Daniel, as you said earlier, and also said Mohsen, that basically what Washington is doing is trying to threaten Iran. So I want to look at that side of things. In a new Biden administration, do you think that this is the line that's going to be continued, that they want to create more pressure against Iran? Or do you see a possibility of the Biden administration going in a different direction?
I believe it's the former. I think that the Biden administration will maintain as hard a line against Iran as the Trump administration, if not even harder. I mean, it's determined to do the bidding of Israel as much as Trump did, and Israel has just one priority. It sees Iran as its strategic enemy, the most dangerous force in the middle in the entire region. It wants Iran beaten back. Even, you know, to the point of imposing regime change. The U.S. has happily joined in that, you know, in that viewpoint, and I don't see Biden really differing from that at all.
Mm.
Even Biden's rhetoric about the JCPOA. I mean, Biden has made it clear that he will only re-enter the JCPOA if he's able to gain further concessions from Iran regarding its support for the Syrian government, Hezbollah, Shiite forces in Iraq, and of course the Houthis in Yemen. So Biden is determined to increase the diplomatic pressure on Iran over what Trump had already imposed.
Do you see, staying with what you've just said? Do you see this new administration more or less pro-Zionist than the previous administration?
At least as much as the previous administration, if not more so. The alliance between the U.S. and Israel just gets closer and closer. And that means that the U.S. adopts Israel's most militant attitudes vis-a-vis Iran. So I just don't see any hope for any kind of, you know, realignment in the Persian Gulf. I just see an ever tougher stance on the part of the U.S.
Well, said Mohsen, some experts say that Abu Dhabi sold out its Palestinian brethren for basically $23 billion worth of military equipment and accepted to normalize relations with Israel. Your take on that assessment, and overall, what does it mean? Not only, of course, we saw that with the UAE, but we also saw it with Sudan and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain.
Well, of course, the American policy in the Middle East is primarily, obviously, for raping oil and resources of that region. Secondly, to maintain dictators and leaders who basically don't give individual sovereignty to the nations, but rather support the interests of Israel and America. That's been going on for decades. And finally, of course, as we said, the cash cow business of taking arms sales is now the more obvious one. So, look, the thing is, I think that the bottom line is that the UAE and this normalization process was part of really that entire overall American and Israeli joint policy in the region. It's just now that they really called in their, if you like, their erstwhile silent partners to come into openly normalizing. And what the UAE is doing is essentially putting all of its eggs in the basket of the Zio-American imperialist powers in that region. And of course, it is on the borders of Iran, well, on the sea borders at least. And that poses, a huge threat for Iran. It also poses a problem for the UAE, because if the saber rattling that goes on between Israel and Iran, or America and Iran, continues, and somebody, you know, decides to take a rash move, of course, these bases in the UAE are some of the bases which will launch any possible attacks on Iran. And Iran and the establishment has already made it very, very clear several times. The administration has made it clear that the allies of Israel, those who are normalizing Israel's apartheid in Palestine, those who are supporting terrorist organizations across the Middle East, those who are undermining the independence and integrity of the people of the region, the ordinary citizens, are on their target list as well. And if anything happens to Tehran, or anything happens to the major nerve centers of certainly the Islamic Republic, the UAE, Abu Dhabi, etc., will all be number one on the hit list. And Tel Aviv, of course, it has also been warned. So it is a really fragile situation, and the world really needs to take note. There's an ambivalence in America, there's an ambivalence across the world stage in this Cold War, or this hot war, which is actually being played out as well, simultaneously. But the world is going to ill afford to ignore this for very much longer, because it only takes a little mistake, a little calculation to go wrong. Right. And what we can see happen with the case of General Soleimani, and the tolerance and the patience that the Islamic Republic employed by only attacking one or two American sites, could run out, and they may be forced to go further. The military exercises in the Gulf, the American B-52s that have been flying to and from, these military sales to the UAE, all of this is the drums of war.
Okay.
Something which I think the whole international community has to step in and to de-escalate.
Daniel, your assessment of it all, you just heard Syed Mohsen talk about it only takes a spark to basically light up the whole area. With this situation, we see the increase of weapons that being sold by Washington or London to these regional countries. Your assessment of the possibility of even further destabilization?
Well, it's very hard to predict, but I think in the long run, we can safely say that the likelihood is steadily rising. I mean, the U.S. is assembling its anti-Iranian coalition. It is stuffing the region filled with arms, ever more so. The area is bristling with weaponry, and it just takes a spark to set off the conflagration. And we don't know what will happen. It didn't happen after the assassination of Soleimani. Didn't happen after the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist. But the next incident could. It's so hard to predict, but the general trend seems clear. The situation is growing more and more dangerous.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar out of New York and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. That is because Allah is the truth, and that which they call upon other than Him is falsehood, and because Allah is the Most High, the Grand.
ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْحَقُّ وَأَنَّ مَا يَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِهِ هُوَ الْبَاطِلُ. That is because Allah, He is the truth, and what they call upon besides Him, it is falsehood. وَأَنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْعَلِيُّ الْكَبِيرُ. And because Allah, He is the High, the Great. So, previously, we discussed the 61st verse of this chapter, and now we're into the 62nd. In that verse, we said that it also started with ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ, that is because Allah merges the night into the day, and also vice versa. And this was indicating that the power and knowledge of Allah in relation to changing the day and night is taken as a sign for His ability in helping the servants. And in this verse,
There is an evidence mentioned for what was said earlier. It says, ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْحَقِّ. That is because Allah, He is the truth. وَأَنَّ مَا يَدْعُونَ مِن دُونِهِ هُوَ الْبَاطِلِ. And what they call upon besides Him, it is falsehood. So the verse says, هُوَ الْحَقِّ. The only criterion to actually distinguish what is right from wrong, what is actually true from falsehood, is the Almighty Allah Himself, and of course His words. Anyway, you may see that the army of truth becomes victorious, the falsehood retreats, and the grace of Allah hastens to help the believers and leaves the disbelievers alone. All these are for the sake that the latter ones are wrong and the former ones are right. One is actually against the system of the world of universe, and their end is destruction and annihilation. And while these are in agreement with the laws of the world of existence, and what I just said, I said you may see that the army of truth becomes victorious, is because their end is destruction and annihilation. The question is whether you will see the end or not, but whether you be alive or not, their end is annihilation.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
In principle, Allah is the truth, and other than Him is futile. And all those human beings and other beings that contact with Allah are somehow right, and as much as they are aloof from Him, they are wrong. And at the end, the verse says, وَأَنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْعَلِيُّ الْكَبِيرُ. And that Allah, He is the High, the Great. The Arabic word Ali is derived from Uluv, which means actually high ranked. It is also applied for someone who is capable and almighty, and no one can resist before His will. And you see that this verse is actually indicating a proof and evidence for the previous verses. It is mentioned for us to believe in the Almighty Allah's aid, in the Almighty Allah's promise for helping the ones who are in need of His help, but of course on the condition that they have started to defend themselves, and the Almighty Allah will hasten to help them as well. Moving on, the last word of the verse is كبير وأن الله هو العلي الكبير, the High, the Great. The word great refers to the grandeur of knowledge and power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and He who is qualified with these attributes can can help his friends really well. In fact, both of these two verses, the 61st and 62nd, are actually as a proof for the part in the 60th verse, where it says, لَيَنْصُرَنَّهُ اللَّهُ إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَعَفُوٌ غَفُورٌ. So the Almighty Allah will most certainly help and aid him, the one who is oppressed. And with this verse, there remains no justification for not believing in the Almighty Allah's help and aid. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
Open the windows! Let the world hear!
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners.
My name is Muzaffar Abbas Haider.
I am Murtaza Rezavi.
And I am Brother Ali Shah.
And we're here to bring you a letter for you. A recent letter from Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, has left the West tapping their toes in confusion. The point is that the West is very, very confused about what's happened. You see, the letter is a baffling notion for the West. Why, Irtiza?
Because first of all, it's from an Eastern leader, specifically a Muslim leader.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, an Iranian leader. Mm-hmm. So, like, I mean, I don't really need to explain why it's baffling.
The name of what, Brother Irtiza?
He is the supreme leader of Iran, which is Ayatollah Khamenei. He is the successor to Ayatollah Khomeini, who brought the Islamic Revolution in Iran, just, I'm guessing, about 35, 36 years ago.
That's right. And in this letter, Ayatollah Khamenei is basically telling the West of the youth, that's right, this letter is addressed exclusively to you. And if there are anybody older listening, and I'm sorry, but it's not exactly for you. But you can read it too, which is a great thing. Now, the letter is telling the people of the West, the youths of the West, to wake up, to start looking around, to start researching, to start understanding what Islam is from its core, which of course is the Holy Quran and the Hadith, and not just from the mainstream media. Why is it a baffling notion, Irtiza, for Western people to see an Eastern leader telling the people to think?
It's a baffling thing because the Eastern leader...
Brother, you cannot use words like baffling, what it means.
I'm sure they know what baffling means.
Well, let's just say that, Ali, you are quite baffled at the word baffle.
I'm not baffled, bro.
You know what it means?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Baffled means when you are really...
When you're confused.
Confused.
Ali, do you know what? You can go and look at a dictionary later on after the show.
Okay. Back to the main topic. What was the question you asked again? Sorry?
Why is it confusing for the West to see an Eastern leader?
It's an Eastern leader. He's not from the West. Mm-hmm. West... generally, I'm giving a generalization, it's more open-minded.
People
more,
associate the West with being open-minded.
Like, yeah, people associate the West of being open-minded, forward-thinking, more scientifically like shrewd and strong. This is from the East. This comes out from East, from Iran. From Iran, which is a very, which is a country that's very hot in the news for the, I would say since the revolution, since the Islamic revolution came to Iran, it's been very hot in the news. It's been a very big subject about sanctions, nuclear power, whatever, and so forth. However, this is a letter from the Iranian leader, the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, addressing the youth of the West, specifically to use their own mind, be free, and make their own decisions, and basically think for themselves. Yeah. Like, for instance, they have around them a whole array of news outlets coming from the East and the West, okay, and the North and wherever, saying, this is Islam, this isn't Islam, this is the way it is, this is the war on terror, this is what we're promising, we're promising against terrorism, Muslims are terrorists, so on and so forth. It's some people would argue that it's even gone towards Islamophobia. So this is basically the supreme leader of Iran saying to the students, I'm guessing students and youth, that think for yourself, don't follow, like, listen to your elders, respect your elders, don't follow them blindly.
Yeah. I mean, he does use words like understand, think, research, investigate.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly
really things that you'd expect to hear from a Middle Eastern leader. Going back to what you said about Islamophobia, I'd like to focus on that today, inshallah. Now, Islamophobia in the West, first of all, let's look at the word Islamophobia. What does Islamophobia actually mean? This is where we go to our brother Ali. Ali, would you please care to explain to us the word Islamophobia?
Like, you know the word phobia? It means like
fear.
When you're going against something, like Islamophobia is like...
The word phobia means fear.
Fear
of something.
Like, in a way, like, it gives a lot of fear in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So what they mean by Islamophobia is they're fearing Islam.
A fear of Islam,
yeah.
That's pretty much what it means. Would you say, I mean, you're from Scotland.
Yes.
Now, back in Scotland, would you describe the sort of impression that people have in the north of Britain as fear? Like, what they think of the Muslims as fear?
I think most of the people back home in the UK, not only Scotland, I think everywhere, they fear Islam. Like, if there's a guy who is a Muslim, they will think he's a terrorist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or they will avoid him. If there's a man, he's a Christian or a Catholic or a Jewish person, they would have more trust in him than a Muslim. Imagine now, I went for a job interview, and I am really clever, I have all the degrees, I have all the knowledge. But then there's a man who's a Jewish or a Christian.
Or even an atheist.
Atheist. Uh-huh. He will be chosen before me.
If I could say
they do not trust Muslims.
Yeah.
They have no trust in the Muslims. They believe that we only bring terror. We have no love, because when they open the Quran, if, for example, if you give a person in another faith the Quran, the first part he is going to read is kill the disbelievers.
It's a quote which is handed out quite a bit.
Yeah,
in regards
now
to the
they
Quran.
Believe that we are the religion of terror and violence.
Irtaza, do you agree with this?
To be honest, I'd like to interject and basically say, is that more of a stereotype? That, like, for instance, I agree, yes, to a degree that Muslims have been under the backlash. Like how we discussed earlier, nearly through every period of time, there's been groups of people who have been persecuted. Like, for instance, the Jews have been persecuted. Black people have been persecuted during the slavery and everything. Red Indians, Native Indians, Aborigines, everyone's been, like, to an extent, oppressed and persecuted. Is this, like, does this hold some truth, but we're just kind of using it and saying, oh, when I go for a job interview, it's because I'm Muslim, they don't allow me.
Uh-huh.
Is it like that, or, like, is it really more than that? Because, like, as far as I've understood it, Islamophobia is that exists amongst ignorant people, to be honest. If that's not a, like, I don't want to come too harsh, but amongst intellectuals,
to be honest with you, even the people that seem to be really nice to the Muslims, in their heart or somewhere in their mind, they hate us. You know,
going back to what it is,
very
said
strong
about
words,
brother Muzaffar.
Yeah, go on.
One point I would like to make is that people see the religion of Islam as a really, like, fair religion. They think all we care about is killing people, terror, no love, no peace. And because of this matter is spreading through the whole nation now. Everyone is thinking Islam is wrong. Islam is wrong.
Yeah, but that's... It can be very easily argued that when you turn on the news, what do you see? I mean, pre-9/11, basically. Before 9/11, I remember going to school. I remember going in our daily life back in London. And to be honest, everything was so normal. So normal, so peaceful.
This is before 2001? This is...
Yeah, before 9/11.
Before 9/11, 2001.
I didn't experience any hostility, nothing, to be honest with you. Okay, every now and then someone...
I'll have to agree with you. Everything was nice.
Someone would turn around and be like, oh, yeah, Paki, this and that, you're brown or whatever.
Yeah.
But it wasn't any, like, real...
There was no hostility.
Real hostility. But as soon as...
When I used to go to school before the 9/11, people used to say to me, you're a curry muncher.
Curry muncher, but that's different to religion.
Racism.
The racism.
Racism is different to religion.
Yeah.
Like, that's a completely different story that, to be honest, through every time and every place as it has existed.
The thing about Islamophobia is it can target a black person, a white person, a Chinese person, if they've got a big beard and if they're wearing a hat.
Now,
going back to the letter for a moment, it says, Ayatollah Khamenei is saying, I would like to talk to you, i.e. the youth, about Islam, particularly the image that is presented to you as Islam. He says that many attempts have been made over the past two decades, almost since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, to place this great religion in the seat of a horrifying enemy. Is this something you'd agree with?
Yeah, in my opinion, yeah. I would agree with that 100%, to be honest, that since, well, I wasn't there since in the Soviet Union time, but like I said, after 9/11, and if you look through history, That is almost a very exact presentation of what is happening to Islam at the moment. Like, for instance, the most funniest thing out of all is that most of this depiction is coming out from, like, Saudi rulership, Saudi infiltration. If you look towards, like, Africa and this stuff, it was completely peaceful until the Saudi version of Islam reached there. Same with the West. Like, when the Saudi version of Islam reached there... Like,
what do you mean by the Saudi version of Islam?
This is amongst most Muslims. Like,
you're talking about very right-wing Islam.
Very right-wing, like, for instance...
the people who believe that, for example... Wahhabism.
Wahhabism, yeah. They believe that the Shias worship graves. They do not worship Allah.
Not just
their views against us are really, really horrific as well.
Not just Shias, I would just like to point, like, their view against everybody. Everybody. Like, forget about Shias.
I think they're
like,
okay.
Like,
Wahhabism are okay with Christians. They're okay with the Americans, with the, like, even Catholics, Christians. They have a big problem against the Shias.
They have a really big problem with the Shias because that's within Islam itself. But the Wahhabi, actually, school of thought itself, like, it's very contradicting to itself. Like, some stuff they say, their books are completely against. But anyway, that's a completely different topic to get into.
Yeah, that's true.
But...
Now, this right-wing ideology of Islam, which is very... I don't want to use the word extremist, but I guess that is what it is. It's taking one fundamental principle of Islam and it's taking it to its extreme while disregarding everything else. Like, they're the types of Muslims that you'd see making blanket statements. They're the types of Muslims that you'd see cutting people's heads off. The types of Muslims that you'd see even blowing themselves up. Now, would you say that this Islamophobia, which is spreading, is... solely due to these types of right-wing Muslims?
I would say they fuel it. They fuel the fire, but solely to say, even though I love the media has a hell of a lot to play in this assault. Like, for instance, a simple example. Somebody gets stabbed in London. They're not going to turn around and be like, youth did a stabbing over whatever, whatever, whatever. However, if it's a Muslim youth, they'll be like, a Muslim youth of 22 years old in a gang fight stabbed someone. It's like, what happened to, like, if it was someone, some normal youth, you'd just be like, a youth stabbed someone in a gang fight. But when it comes to a Muslim youth, Muhammad ibn something, 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 stabbed him in a gang fight. I don't see the correlation.
I can completely agree. But I mean, who was that psychopath who went around killing people in somewhere in Europe?
Breivik, the guy with blonde hair. He was actually a Christian.
He was a
But that was never plastered around.
Do you know, he actually made a book... With a whole manifesto in it. It had the crucifix at the on the front page.
Really?
It was a thick book about how he wants to, you know, evangelize America, how he wants to evangelize the West, how he wants to evangelize Europe.
Like a mini crusade.
A mini crusade. Yeah. Now, when the media looks at this character, they never, ever point the finger at Christianity.
No.
This is something that we always know. Now, would you say that the right-wing Muslims within the Ummah, would you say that they exist because they've taken certain verses of the Quran out of context?
To be honest, this is a very deep thing. Like, for instance, there's conspiracy theories about this, there's some truth about it, mm-hmm. some like flesh to the bone, where these people are unfortunately misguided mm-hmm. because of their teachers, but unfortunately their teachers have some type of link to yeah. dirty politics,
yeah.
like Saudi politics with money. Or it really has nothing to do with religion. It's all about money.
Uh-huh.
It's all about the money. It comes from there. It comes from there, but then yeah. it stems off. Like when it gets into these people's minds, then it's like a plague. To be honest,
mm.
I can't put it any other way. It's like a plague. It starts from someone doing something stupid,
yeah.
like some dirty deal being done, like AIDS yeah. or something like that, uh-huh. and then it just continues and like spirals out of control. Uh-huh. And then due to this assault that is also being flung upon the Muslims, this makes them even more radical. They're like, everyone hates us anyway.
I think that has to be dissected very deeply. What you brothers have said is correct, but we will have to go more deeply and research more, and yeah. then we will continue, inshallah.
I completely agree with you. I think it's a lot more that we need to discuss in order to actually get to the bottom of this. Just going back to the verse which you quoted, which is often thrown around, it's actually chapter 2, verse 191
okay.
of the Holy Quran. It says, "And kill them wherever you find them, and drive them out from whence they drove you out, and persecution is severer than slaughter. And do not fight them at the sacred mosque until they fight with you in it. But if they do fight you, then slay them. Such is the recompense of the unbelievers."
No, brother, I have one point to make.
Mm-hmm.
Many people give the Quran to the non-believers as mm-hmm. a gift when they have never, ever read the Quran themselves
yeah.
properly. So if you give a Quran to your friend, a non-believer,
yeah.
and the first page he opens, just imagine he comes to that page.
Oh.
And he's like, kill the believers.
You see, the thing is,
so then why is he going to think in his mind that Islam?
No, I completely agree with you. But the thing about
that's
this
what it's
is,
taken out of context. You have to. Also it
is
that.
Like this verse is focused on, and usually, to be honest, it's always the first line of this verse, "and kill them wherever you find them," and they don't read the rest of the verse, mm. nor do they read the verse before it and after it. The verse before it says, "And fight in the way of Allah with those who fight with you, and do not exceed the limits. Surely Allah does not love those who exceed the limits." The verse straight after that says, "But if they desist, then surely Allah is forgiving, merciful." Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, do remember to never take things out of context. And when we're actually showing people what Islam is, it's important to give them a holistic view of Islam and not just a one-sided view. I think that's where the main problem has come from. And it's fueled this Islamophobia, which, inshallah, we will talk about more in the next episode. From myself, Muzaffar Abbas Haider.
From me, Irtiza Rezavi.
And from me, your loving brother, Alisha.
We hope that you have enjoyed listening, and inshallah, we look forward to seeing you next time. Assalamu alaikum.
A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
Around the world with reporters.
The number of people sleeping on the streets at night across the European Union is growing by the day amid the pandemic. Welfare systems are under enormous strain. We have been speaking to one homeless man in Brussels who is finding it difficult to acquire emergency accommodation.
It's very hard in the cold, in the winter. It's very hard to feel good, to find somewhere. It's very difficult.
A debate on the worsening social crisis in the EU resulting from COVID-19 has been held in the European Parliament.
We have a problem here. The slow, sluggish bureaucracy of the European Union is not compatible with emergencies like the one we face today.
Governments in the EU are being urged to submit pandemic recovery plans to the European Commission so that €750 billion in available funding can be released without any further delay.
Millions of people lost already their jobs, and they are mainly the low-skilled, the low-paid workers, the temporary workers, the young on precarious work.
The European Parliament debate was told the EU social crisis could last for many years unless action is taken to save economies.
Thousands of businesses have temporarily or permanently closed.
Millions of Europeans have lost their jobs and livelihoods.
Many EU legislators say the 27-country bloc's vaccination program is being delivered too slowly. To make matters worse, experts in the UK are suggesting the new variant of COVID-19 discovered last year in England might be more deadly than previously thought. EU officials are concerned new variants of the disease might be resistant to approved vaccines and vaccines awaiting approval. With that comes obvious health concerns, but also incredible economic uncertainty. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics is that has found that large swaths of mostly young and highly educated Italians have continued to move abroad in search of working opportunities. Italy's young workers have been living for decades. However, the report has highlighted that over 300,000 Italians aged 18 to 39 emigrated to neighboring European countries and overseas between 2015 and 2019, up 33% compared to 2014. One in three of them were graduates.
These figures show that young Italians, particularly from the rich north, choose to leave the country because the labor market doesn't offer them any prospects. This is why young people from the depressed Italy south continue to emigrate to northern cities. We are calling on the government to invest more in the youth, in its recovery and resilience plan, the investment project using European Union funds to counter the effect of the pandemic.
Youth unemployment level in Italy stands at about 40%. Furthermore, 3 out of 10 Italians between 18 and 24 years of age are not in employment, education or training, the third highest percentage among OECD countries.
A recent study by the European Commission has found that Italy, along with Poland and Romania, is among the European countries that send the most workers abroad. This brain drain costs Italy an estimated 14 billion euros every year.
It's an inconceivable waste. Once trained through our school system, our young Italians offer their skills to foreign countries. It's true, our labor market is stagnant, but it must be said that quite often the system does not reward merit.
Successive Italian governments had long tried attracting back talented workers with tax breaks, with no success. However, a counter-exodus of the brain drain seems to be underway since the start of the pandemic. Data from Italy's foreign ministry shows that in 2020, the number of young Italians returning home increased about 20% over the previous year. Max Civili, Rome.
A London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission made a plea with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, reminding the illegal grounds on which top cleric Sheikh Zazaki and his wife were being kept in prison. Simultaneously, the Islamic Human Rights Commission has also written to the United Nations asking the international body to exert pressure on Nigeria to do the same. Lawyer to the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, has expressed shock that 7 days after testing positive to COVID-19, Zazaki's wife, Zinat, is yet to be hospitalized. Also in a press conference, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that keeping Malama Zinat in Kaduna prison without hospitalization has violated the known guidelines and protocols for the prevention of the spread of COVID-19.
The task force for the COVID-19 pandemic, they went around even sharing, distributing contacts that whenever you see somebody affected, you should call them. They will come and immediately evacuate such a person for treatment. But that of Malama Zina, she's there for 7 days. Till today, she's still in the prison custody.
In December 2015, security forces attacked Zazaki's house and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters and 3 of his biological children. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said it will continue to demand justice for Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We call on the masses to join us in calling for justice. We call on the relevant authorities to respect the law of the land and immediately and unconditionally release the couples, as court has ordered for their immediate release.
Zazaki's son, Muhammad, said up to now his mother, Zinat, is still in Kaduna prison and is yet to be hospitalized. The Islamic movement in Nigeria and Zazaki's son are both calling on the authorities to ensure that she receives proper medical care and to release Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife with immediate effect. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
Travel agents in 13 different countries should get ready for a rush of customers. The United States has finally lifted its shockingly xenophobic and unprecedented travel ban. Iran was one of six other Muslim-majority nations which were primarily targeted, which caused ex-President Donald Trump's executive order to become called the Muslim travel ban, informally and infamously. New President Joe Biden ended the ban on his first day in office. The bigotry lasted 4 years, and the damage to American citizens, countless non-Americans, and America's image cannot be overestimated.
The real shame in this is not simply turning our back on, America's tradition of not judging people on the basis of their religion or our constitutional prohibition against that. But what's really, troubling about this is that we have gone through this process where family members have not been able to be together with loved ones.
Husbands and wives have been kept apart for years. Grandparents passed away without seeing their newborn grandchildren. Weddings, graduations, birthdays, funerals, jobs, business deals, educational exchanges. The accumulation of grief and difficulty caused by the Islamophobic ban is appalling. In many ways, the ban backfired, because it emphatically demonstrated the scope and reach of state-sponsored Islamophobia, something which had been routinely denied by the right and the left, not only in the United States, but across the West.
It's really going to require that we go through the hard work of actually implementing policies, not just in travel, but in other ways that fight against Islamophobia, because we know that it has been a feature in our society, certainly for the last 30 years, but even long before that.
The ban led to doctor shortages in a United States which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former US President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The U.S. is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The U.S. should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the U.S. decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for, and you would see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions. So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that, and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances, and our choices are wide.